Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do certain stories stay with us long after the first time we've seen or heard or read them? And what is it that compels us to want to experience them over and over? Broadway producer Jeffrey Seller has clearly demonstrated his gift for identifying such stories and for bringing them to life in instant classics like his Tony Award-winning productions of Rent, Avenue Q, and In the Heights. Since childhood, Seller himself has been fascinated by J.M. Barrie's stories of the mercurial Peter Pan, and now he's bringing that character, along with Captain Hook, Wendy, Tinkerbell, and the Lost Boys, to life with a musical production he is directing himself at the Dallas Theater Center. Fly debuts there July 2nd and runs through August 18th, and we are delighted to have Jeffrey Seller here on his one day off this week to talk about it. Jeffrey, welcome to Think.
Good afternoon, Chris. It's really wonderful to be here. Thank you.
What was it about this story that you loved as a kid? And did you read the Barrie version or did you see the Disney version?
I think Peter Pan is a character that I don't know when he came into my consciousness. I think he was always there. I can't tell you, oh, I saw this television version or movie that put... Peter's always been inside of me, I think. And when I was in fourth grade, I was in my first play. And very soon after, I decided I was going to write a play. So I wrote a play called Adventureland about my two best friends and I going up on the roof shed in my backyard and falling through into a strange and dangerous place called Adventureland. And we were beset by many adventures and many life-threatening situations. And in this play that I wrote, our eventual savior was, in fact, Peter Pan. Hmm. That's fourth grade.
Before you had to think about the budget for staging something that elaborate.
Yes,
right?
Before I encountered this extravaganza that we're making at the Dallas Theater Center. And so I like to think that Peter's just always been with me. And it was a character I kept going back to and wanting to explore in a deeper, more personal way.
Hmm. A lot of people don't know, you know, you can sort of look at Peter Pan as a fantasy or you can look at it as a kind of nightmare. And J.M. Barrie had some sort of darker inspirations for this story than people might realize.
Well, fantasy and nightmare. No question, I have been interested in projecting both the fantasy that this provides for Wendy and the nightmare as well. No doubt Barrie was a man that lived in a lot of darkness and in a lot of light. And in this production, I think that we've tried to uncover both.
He had a brother who died in childhood.
Oh, Lord. Well, if we're going to go there, not only did he have a brother who died in childhood, but his mother forced him to wear his brother's clothes to make her feel better because she was so, so heartbroken over her son's death. And yes.
So you talked about, you know, the fantasy and the nightmare this provides for Wendy. Is this more Wendy's story than we usually realize? Do we always think it's Peter's story? And in fact, what we're looking at is Wendy's story.
Very interesting. You know, the musical is called Fly. And when J.M. Barrie originally concocted it, he called it Peter Pan. And it was a play in the West End around 1905. But what he did thereafter was he wrote the novel. He wrote the novel about 4 or 5 years after, in fact, he wrote the play. The novel is our source material. When the novel was published in around 1911, it was called Peter and Wendy. And that's our source. And, you know, I'll try to describe the first paragraph of the novel. But there's only one name mentioned in this paragraph, and it's called Wendy. And the novel opens like this. He says, all children except one grow up. They soon know that they will grow up. And the way that Wendy knew was this. One day when she was 2 years old, she was playing in the garden. And she picked another flower and she ran with it to her mother. And I suppose she must have looked rather delightful because her mother put her hand to her heart and she cried, oh, why can't you remain like this forever? That's all that passed between them on the topic. But henceforth, Wendy knew that she must grow up. Hmm. You always know when you are two. Two is the beginning of the end. That's the first paragraph of Barry's novel. That is the inspiration for our play.
And there is, I think our generation of adults maybe struggles with this question of whether it is wonderful to remain childlike forever or whether it is better to grow up in a way that I don't think our parents and grandparents' generations, I don't think they lost a lot of sleep over those questions.
No doubt. I think if we go back to our grandparents, they were worried about the Great Depression, World War II, and so many other bigger issues. And growing up was valiant.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're listening on the radio to Avril Lavigne's top 10 pop song, Here's to Never Growing Up. Sorry, Avril, you're a grown up. You can say you don't want to grow up, but you are. And I think that that song is a perfect distillation right now of how people can be feeling in their 20s, 30s. I'm 48, and I still encounter feelings of, oh, I don't want to grow old.
Mm-hmm.
And I think growing up and growing old are almost synonymous with each other. And I think that these issues are ubiquitous in our culture.
And of course, for Peter Pan, he has everything that kids love about being a kid and none of the responsibilities that come along with adulthood. I mean, granted, he is fighting for his life on a number of occasions, but we sort of know he's going to make it out alive.
Yeah, I mean, Peter has absolutely no responsibility. Sometimes I refer to him as having ADD because he just goes with whatever he's feeling at any given moment. He bores very quickly and moves on to the next topic. And he's only concerned about his own fun.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's incredibly magnetic, incredibly charismatic, but tiring at the end in some regard because he's kind of lost in the middle.
So what are the challenges for you as a director in this production with making a character that is very compelling and charismatic? Also, do you need to make him sympathetic, or is that just not part of the formula?
Oh, I'm very interested in what makes us relate to Peter and feel for him in the same way that I am interested in what makes us feel, be affected by Wendy and be affected by Hook. Because at the end of the day, all of them have something to share with us about this growing process. You know, I like to think I'm asking, what's the cost of growing up? What's the cost of not growing up? And then what's the gain if we dare to embrace growing up and growing old? And all three of them are illuminating different sides of those questions.
So is Hook misunderstood?
I think we're going to understand him perfectly well in this production. I don't think he's misunderstood, but I think he's a lot like a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
He doesn't want to grow old. He doesn't want to grow up. What's he doing on this ship? And where's he going?
So talk about, you have this idea. At this point, you're at a place in your career where you can have an idea and make it into an actual thing. But how did you go about deciding who you wanted to work with to do the score and the script and the choreography and everything to make it the production that you had dreamed of?
Oh, wow. Big question. Thank you. Well, first I said I want to do Peter Pan. And there was another force that was going on, that at the same time that I got this idea to do Peter Pan, I was taking my kids to this drum night that was happening at the beach where I live in New York every Monday night. It was a drum circle with djembes and alfayas and shakers and everybody from the community was just coming on down with this kind of Brazilian samba band and doing this drum night. And even if we didn't go, we'd hear it from the house. And I was like, wow, I love these drums and my kids love it. And then I hired them to come and play a party. It was the celebration party that I hosted at my home after In the Heights won the Tony for Best Musical. So at the same time that I'm thinking about Peter Pan, I'm thinking about these drums. And I thought, I want to do Peter Pan on an island with drums because that's what would be on an island.
Mm-hmm.
because you wouldn't hear a trumpet on an island. You wouldn't hear a steel instrument like a trombone on an island, but you'd hear drums, and it would be like indigenous to the island. And so then I thought, okay, I want to do Peter Pan with drums and percussion. So that was the beginning. That was the first notion. And then this notion of exploring those questions about growing up, cost of growing up. And then that led me to, okay, I've got to find a playwright who's my partner. That was the first question. Mm-hmm. Who is going to be the playwright who is equally passionate about this material and sees it in a similar vein? And that led me to Rajiv Joseph, who was just rising in his career right then. And his agent gave me a copy of his play, Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo. Not obvious material for Peter Pan, I might add.
Right.
The words were flying off the page in a way that was fierce and funny and angry and deeply, deeply sad. And I sent Rajiv a paper that I wrote. I wrote like a 10-page short story of my interpretation of Barry, and explained what I was up to and said, "Are you interested?" And he immediately, through his agent, said yes. And then I went out to L.A. and met him, where he was doing the very first production of Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo. And he and I got together on the roof of the hotel where I was staying, and we sat and talked for 3 hours. And early in our conversation, he said, "I've always loved Peter Pan. I always thought that Peter's a superhero, and my favorite interpretation was frankly the cartoon, because then it was really a boy."
Hmm.
And we both also sat there with this huge value. We loved Peter Pan, but we didn't like the fact that, sorry, middle-aged women were always playing him on stage.
And I have to say thank you for that, because it makes no sense. There's no, the essence of boyness just doesn't exist. And as a 42-year-old woman, I would be really not convincing.
We can't, granted, theater is about the suspension of disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
However, how far can we go? And if we really want to struggle with and explore the issues of what it means to grow up, we're never going to be able to really do that if we're watching a middle-aged woman play Peter Pan. And that comes out of the panto tradition in England, where they would do stuff like men would play women, women would play men. And it's fun to make a very broad comedy for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great thing. But if we really want to get into the nitty-gritty of Barry's novel, then how about if we actually use a boy who's prepubescent? And it sounds so obvious, and yet I have to tell you, to my knowledge, there has never been a production of Peter Pan on Broadway in which Peter was played by a prepubescent boy. Though when we start previews in 8 days at the Dallas Theater Center, Peter will be played by a prepubescent 12-year-old boy.
My guest is Jeffrey Seller. He's the Tony Award-winning producer of Broadway shows, including Rent, Avenue Q, and In the Heights. And he is directing Fly, which opens July 2nd at the Dallas Theater Center and runs through August 18th. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment and invite you to join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
forget your face. Forget the walls, the floor, this place. Forget your hands, forget your feet. Forget the way you talk and eat. Forget the things you used to know. You don't need to think or learn or grow. Just forget the ground, forget the sky. 'Cause the more you forget, the higher you will fly. You fly high as you can to the heavens.
That is Morgan Weed performing the song Fly from the musical Fly, which is being produced at the Dallas Theater Center and runs July 2nd through August 18th. We have the show's director, Jeffrey Seller, here, who is also a Tony Award-winning producer of multiple Broadway shows, including Rent, Avenue Q, and In the Heights. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Do you feel, Jeffrey, like that song sort of sets the tone for what you're doing here?
Yeah, that song answers the major question that we asked ourselves, what makes Peter fly? And how is he going to teach Wendy and John to fly? And I think many people might remember from the Mary Martin production that it was the notion of thinking happy thoughts, I think, was the way that you learned to fly. And what we really interpreted from the book was that because Peter's always living in the moment, he's always forgetting. He has like this kind of strange form of dementia where he only remembers what he wants and what he needs at any given moment. And we thought, well, then the way that you have to fly is to forget. And given that Wendy has been grounded in our production by her mother for skipping school, and their family life has been challenged lately, they have a lot to forget. And Peter, in this scene, is teaching them how to fly, and he's saying, forget everything. Forget your mom, forget your dad, forget anything that makes you sad, and whoop, up you go. And then, of course, as soon as you start remembering, down you go. And that really, though that's not how they do it in the book absolutely deals with the notion that when Wendy and John go to Neverland, as they get further and further enveloped in the environment of Neverland, they start forgetting things. Wendy starts to go, oh, I'm barely remembering mother and I'm barely remembering father. And then John's starting to forget stuff. And it might very well be that wanting to remember helps to get them to want to finally go home.
Yeah, so I guess there's this struggle, this temptation to just live in the moment like Peter does, or to take, I suppose living in the moment also means you don't take much back with you.
Oh, my goodness. What is life but memory?
Mm-hmm.
If we don't have our memories, we have nothing, because our lives are a series of events that put us where we are today. Peter is full of joy, but he also has no connections. Everybody eventually leaves him. They go back home, or they die, and then he's left alone, and he has to just find more people. Wendy ultimately goes back home, grows up, has a daughter. She lives, and she has her memory, and she has a rich life.
So these are big ideas to convey to, as you mentioned, you know, prepubescent kids. Talk about the conversations you've had with the performers in the cast who are, you have some adults as well, but you have a large cast of young people who haven't had these experiences yet, who haven't maybe gotten too far into that process of struggling with whether to grow up and whether it's better to sort of stay young or you know, accept the inevitable processes of aging.
Well, yes, our show, I think we have 28 or 29 people in the company. Eight of the characters are children. There are five Lost Boys plus Wendy, John, and Peter. And I guess I could facetiously say I make them leave the room anytime I talk about the themes of the play, because I don't want to expose them to what it means to grow up and grow old. I want them to hang on to that. And of course, in order to be in the play, they have to be prepubescent. So though we've done several workshops, every time we audition, everybody has to come and audition again, because as soon as your voice changes, you cannot be in our show anymore.
Right.
So the very thing that happens in real life is a reflection of what happens in the play. So in short, I don't want to talk about that with the kids. I want the kids to do the action on the page. I want the kids to stay with their mission. If Wendy's mission is to escape being grounded, is to escape a mother that doesn't listen to her in her own opinion, then I want her to focus on that mission. I want her to focus on, I want to go on an adventure with Peter. I don't want the kids in the show to focus on the themes of the show. I want them to focus on the plot of the show.
To stay pure and faithful to that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, I'm not doing a theme. I'm doing a story. And my job is to tell a great story. Hopefully, I will leave you with a lot of feelings about what you just saw that you can go and think about after you leave. But first and foremost, I want to give you a rollicking good adventure. And that's how I try to talk about it with the children.
So for people who don't know how these things come together, Jeffrey, talk about the difference between a producer and a director and the different kinds of things that you worry about as producer that are not so much your concern as director and vice versa.
Wow. Okay. The producer is the CEO. Mm-hmm. And the director is the chief chef. You know, if I had to say, mm-hmm. If I had to, really describe how that works, the producer might have the idea for the show, or the producer might adopt the idea that was already concocted by the creators, by the writers. The producer's job is to sell for every step of the show's life, to sell it to other artists to come on board as collaborators, to sell it to his or her investors, to sell it to theaters, theater landlords, to sell it to the local press who will do articles and stories and news about it, then to sell it to the group sales agents, then to sell it to the audience, to sell it until he can't sell it anymore. And when he can't sell it anymore, he closes it. The producer is going to hire all of the artists who are going to make this show come alive. I always talk about the producer as being, one part theater lover, theater artist, and one part P.T. Barnum. Mm-hmm. He's a promoter. He's a barker. He's the guy who's going to make it happen. A good producer is going to be a cheerleader for the director and the creative artists who are making the show. He is going to be a father figure, a brother figure, a mother-sister figure. And he's also going to be a critic. He's going to be able to see the forest through the trees and come in and say to the director, look, this is what is working and this is what's not, what isn't working.
So when you're making that decision and you're working with the director, and obviously everyone wants to create the best product possible and the best, to the extent possible, the best piece of art. But what about situations where this might not sell well? There might be some artistic integrity and something the director wants to do for sort of the purity of the work itself. But you know that that's not going to fly when grandma comes in from Grand Rapids and wants to see a show. How do you work through that?
In my role as producer, I have only ever tried to satisfy one audience member, and that's myself. Mm-hmm. If I like it, I hope others will like it too. I go by what pleases me. I don't know what's going to please Grandma from Grand Rapids. And thank you for the Michigan reference. I am from Detroit, Michigan myself.
I know.
When people say, in the theater, people often say, someone said to me once after the first reading we did of Avenue Q, well, it's really good, but I don't know who it's for. And the only conclusion I could reach was it wasn't for him, mm-hmm. because it was for me.
Yeah.
And it seems to continue to be for a lot of people, whether they're kids getting out of college who don't know what they're going to do next, or parents who have children in college, or old people who remember that experience. So I hope that what pleases me will please a lot of audience members. And that is the only barometer I've ever used in my career to know what I should keep and what I should lose, what I should do and what I should not do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with Jeffrey Seller, who will be directing the Dallas Theater presentation of Fly, which opens July 2nd. We have an email here from Steve, who wants to know if there are key decisions in your career that would inspire Broadway hopefuls in any facet of musical theater, things that you would recommend.
Yes. The only thing that was missaid. The most important value that has charged my career with electricity and led to my success are the relationships that I forged when I was young. Two of my first primary relationships in the theater were with my friend Andrew Lippa, the composer-lyricist who composed The Addams Family, Big Fish, and has an oratorio called I Am Harvey Milk opening in San Francisco this week with the San Francisco Gay Men's Choir. And Jonathan Larson, the obvious composer, lyricist, and book writer and creator of Rent. I've known Andrew many, many, many years since before my 20s. I met Jonathan when I was 25, and it was really those relationships that led me to where I am today, because those are the artists that I ultimately wound up coming up and making shows with. When Jonathan and I first became friends when he was 30 and I was 25, he wasn't yet ready to do a Broadway show, and neither was I. But when Rent came 6 years later and I was 31 and he was 35, we were both ready. And I can't assess anybody's skill or talent. Only Steve, you can assess that yourself. But let's say that's the given, that you have the skill and the talent. Who are you going to collaborate with is going to determine how far you go.
Does that make some relationships tricky? Because you might have people who are very dear to you that you wouldn't choose to work with, or whose work wouldn't enhance your own.
Oh my gosh, 100%. And it could cause a friendship to die. I can't say I've had that experience, but there's no doubt that we sometimes have to, when people say, oh, it's nothing personal, I think that they're lying. It's all personal. Because when an artist makes something, they're making themselves. So no one can say to me, oh, I didn't like it, but don't take it personally. Of course I'm going to take it personally.
Yeah. So I suppose there's always a sense of vulnerability when you've put your heart into something, not to mention your money.
Power. Money's almost secondary to the heart.
Yeah.
Money comes and money goes. That's part of life, right? The stock market's down today and we're all going to survive. But our hearts are, we only have one heart. And, every time we nick at it, it dies a little.
So are the stakes any different when you are working on a new production that, say, will debut in Dallas, Texas, as opposed to off-Broadway or on-Broadway? Do they feel any different to you than when you've got a sort of a major production opening on Broadway?
Well, I want to say this. Working for the last 5 weeks in Dallas has been unbelievably happy, comfortable, and creatively profitable. And that's because I'm down here with a enormously talented creative team, enormously talented cast, and all of us are away from New York City and only focused on our own show. We're at Dallas Theater Center Theater Camp, and we're making our musical Fly, and we're able to do that in a bit of a bubble that feels really good for making something. New York is more about selling things, and that's why it feels so good to be here.
So how did you arrive at Dallas as the place to experience this theater camp, as you call it?
Sure. My friend and often colleague, Robin Goodman, introduced me to a extraordinary artist and man named Kevin Moriarty, the artistic director of Dallas Theater Center. He saw an early reading of the play, and he responded to its themes and to its music very, very viscerally. And Kevin, for more than 3 years, has said, "I am interested in this play. Keep sharing it with me." And then about a year and a half ago, we talked with him again, and he said, "I think I want to do your play if you'd be interested in coming here." And I immediately got on a plane. I came down. I saw Giant here. I was amazed by the facility, loved the staff, and that began a relationship that said to us, this will be the ideal place to make this play. Part of it is personal and that we like the people, mm-hmm. and part of it is structural. This is a theater that has a facility that can accommodate a show of the breadth and size of Fly, because it has a proscenium stage. It has the depth and the width and the flying capability that make it perfect for doing our kind of show.
Did you know much about the architecture at the Wiley before you came down here in person?
Forgive me if I mispronounce his name, but I had seen pictures of the Rem Koolhaas building before I came down. There were articles about it in the New York Times where they compared the new Dallas Arts Center to Franklin Lincoln Center. And in its own way, it has greater architectural flair and integrity. So I was familiar with this fantastic cube. And I like to think our show is a circle and a cube, because everything I think about of our show is that we're an island. We're a series of circles. We're an island in the water where the moon is a huge influence on us. And of course, the other influence on anybody growing up is the clock and the ticking of the clock. So we're a circle in this fantastic cube.
My guest is Jeffrey Seller, Tony Award-winning producer of Broadway shows, here in town to direct Fly, his new musical. It opens July 2nd at the Dallas Theater Center and runs through August 18th. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
25,000 moments. How do you measure a year? That is the original Broadway cast recording of Seasons of Love from Rent. My guest this hour is the man who brought the show to Broadway, Tony Award-winning producer Jeffrey Seller. He's in town as a director of his new show, Fly, which opens July 2nd at the Dallas Theater Center and runs through August 18th. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. How much did that show Rent change from the first time you experienced it to the form that it finally took when you brought it to Broadway?
Radical change. When Jonathan and I, when it, the first time he shared with me his ideas about it, that he was going to do La Boheme in the East Village, where AIDS was the disease that Mimi suffers from and not tuberculosis, I thought it was a fantastic idea. Mm-hmm. And so I was down with the idea from day one. The first time he ever did a public reading of it, where actors just sang from chairs, I came to the reading and there were some great songs, but all it really was a collage of Life in the East Village. The plot was not yet in place. The character arcs were not yet in place. And I took two people to see it. One of them said, one of them left at intermission, and the other one said, well, this will never work. And that was in 93, 3 years before Rent happened. And I went to dinner with Jonathan thereafter, and of course he was hoping that I was going to tell him it was wonderful. And I said, you have to decide, do you want to do, you know, just kind of like a concert collage of life in the East Village, or do you want to do a play? And I think he was kind of upset by that, but, you know, he, God bless him, he went off and wrote not just a play, but an extraordinary work of art that still makes me cry. I heard Seasons of Love come on, and it still chokes me up.
You know, we spoke earlier about the fact that you've only ever looked to yourself to see, okay, does this work? Will it connect with people? This show in particular seems like one that obviously artists of all kinds will understand the themes and the story. Was there ever a moment where you thought, I really believe this is a brilliant piece of work? Obviously, La Boheme has a grand history of success, but did you wonder whether people would get it, whether people would shy away in the, you know, early to mid-90s, whether, you know, HIV and AIDS were still something people didn't want to touch?
Oh, well, first of all, that Rent became what it became was the farthest thing from my mind. I loved the show, and Jonathan and I, and then my a business partner, then Kevin, would talk about doing the show in a garage in the East Village for 400 people a night. That's how we conceived. That's how Jonathan thought about it. It was, Jeffrey, go find me a garage, and we're going to do it there. At that point in my life, I was not a full-time Broadway producer. I wasn't a producer at all.
You were not the Broadway producer,
no,
Jeffrey Seller.
We owned this booking agency where we would book the tours of national shows. We were bookers who we were producer wannabes, mm-hmm. who were toiling by day as bookers. And I did not think that Rent would be the show that would change anybody's life. I just thought we would do it in a off-Broadway setting and hope that it would run and be a stepping stone for something. Did I think that it would go to Broadway and run for 12 years and have touring companies and be performed all over the world and win the Pulitzer and the Tony and sell a couple million albums? No, I actually didn't think any of those things. I just hoped that I just figured I hope we don't lose our shirt. You know, mm-hmm. we put, you know, when we were developing this, I was 30 years old. We had almost no money, but the little that we had, we did put into the show, and we just hoped we wouldn't lose it. But if we did, we did.
So now when you have a new production that you know, obviously you never want to lose your shirt. You never want to lose money. But do you have to sort of force yourself to reset to that place where you go into a show and say, okay, I want to have no expectations. I hope it does well. But how hard is it to recapture that after you've had multiple successes so that you are not just brought to your knees if something doesn't do as well as you?
Sure. To put it in context, I had the most wonderful evening with the entire company of Fly, where we all got together and watched the Tony Awards two mm-hmm. weeks ago, at the Hyatt House Hotel where everybody's staying, and we had a party and had fried chicken from Bubba's, and I just watched that show like I have been watching it since I was 13 years old, and I looked at it and I was like, oh, I hope I get to win a Tony someday. Oh, I hope I can go to Broadway someday. And I had every bit of that same sense of hope that I've ever had in my life without any regard for the fact that I've been on that show and won three of those Tonys.
It still feels the same.
All I want to do is be a part of that club. I still don't feel like I'm in.
I guess that's great because then you don't, it's still exciting if you do win.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes. I feel every time making musicals is so hard that every time we go to bat, we're novices. And that goes for all the greats. You know, after Stephen Sondheim and Arthur Lawrence did Gypsy and West Side Story together, they did Anyone Can Whistle, which was a big flop. And then they did that show with Richard Rodgers, and then that was a big flop. So my point is that we all, like, no matter how tried and true and successful we are, it's still a very, very powerfully difficult art form.
Well, I want to talk about that because I think, you know, people still really love live theater. And yet, much like, look, you and I are in very different industries, but people keep predicting the demise of radio. You know, live theater is expensive to produce. It's risky. And, you know, even a smaller production, you bring a lot of people together and you have to get up and go somewhere and be on time. And meanwhile, audiences are accustomed to sort of having everything they want on demand. What do you think it is? Is it the fact that every performance you see of a live show is somehow a completely encapsulated package that no one else except that audience ever gets to see?
Oh, I think that there is something that is in our DNA about attending a live performance with other human beings in which a performer is on a stage relating to us. We know that it's been going on. We have certainly have historical record mm-hmm. that it goes all the way back to ancient Greece,
mm-hmm. and probably back before around campfires.
Absolutely, right. That storytelling tradition, and I don't know what the cause of it is. There must be some scientists who can figure it out. But I just know that it's there and it's powerful. And while the record industry suffered from the advent of the internet and downloading, and while the television business seems to go through their own crisis about their dwindling audience, and the movie business has their own problems with the internet, we don't have those problems in the theater. And I feel like I'm in a wonderful profession now because I know that there is no technology that is ever going to change that basic relationship between audience and artist on stage telling a story. And that's why our numbers in the theater are as good as they've ever been, because there is no technology that's going to replace that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I just have a short story. I grew up in Weatherford, Texas, home of Mary Martin. And so I probably was really influenced by that before I was old enough to really realize it or anything. But we moved to Corpus Christi when I was a kid, and for a short time, a family moved in next door with a little boy a few years older than I was named Jackie Barry. And I was crazy about Peter Pan, probably because of the Weatherford connection. And sometimes he was a really nice kid. He was kind of my idol. He was a little older. And so one time he told me about Peter Pan. He said, the real deal, however he said it back then, is if you really believe in Peter Pan every night before you go to sleep, then he will appear. He'll come to you with Tinkerbell and you'll go flying.
Did you believe it, Michael?
I really believed it. And after my prayers, my mother would come in and I'd do my prayers or whatever. Well, then when she would leave and turn the light off, I would believe in Peter Pan.
That's a sweet story.
Thank you very much. I love it.
I guess it speaks to people's ongoing connection. I suppose that is an advantage when you have a new production that people aren't familiar with yet, that promises to be really exciting, but you already know, people know they're coming to a story that at least they know a little bit about what they're getting.
Yeah. What's great here is that we are going to start in the same place that people know and mm-hmm. have seen before, and we are going to end in the same place that people know have seen before. Everything that many things are going to happen in between that are going to hopefully surprise.
Mm-hmm.
That's my goal. There are some surprises on the way in this, and but at the end of the day, Michael's belief that Peter Pan will come and take him away is absolutely inherent in Wendy's belief as well, and that will be projected on our stage.
We should say this is not a show that you intend only for children, or in fact, even for the very youngest children. I think I saw on the website it said 8 and above.
Yeah,
so.
Well, people say, who's it for? And I know I'm being redundant. I already said it, but I say, well, it's for me.
Mm-hmm.
I have no doubt that children are going to enjoy this show. It's packed with adventure. In some ways, it's like an action-adventure musical. However, adults are going to get something totally, totally different from it. And I made it for us. I made it for those of us who are middle-aged and saying, oh, I'm 40-something, and I can't go back. I can only go forward. And I have some mixed feelings about that.
That is really subversive theater, too, when you can really draw in the adults, right, and the kids have a good time and
yeah.
believe that you took it. You believe that you went to the show for their
yeah.
for their sake.
And the reason they say eight and up is because my goal is also kids like to have fun and be scared. You know, I watched Toy Story 3 when those characters almost went down that chute and got burned to death. That was pretty scary
right.
stuff. So if I can scare them a little bit, I have done my job. And that's why I'm not recommending that 5, 6, and 7-year-olds come to see this play. It's a little bit scary.
Has this project for you been an exercise in coming to terms with being middle-aged and with sort of moving forward with your life, having known, you know, and I'm in the same place, sort of known only youth before now and knowing that what comes after is, you know.
Chris, I used to think I was always the youngest. You know, I was born in October, so I was always the youngest in my class.
Mm-hmm.
I started puberty 2 years late, so I always looked the youngest. I am 48 years old, and I am no longer the youngest.
Mm-hmm. It's a weird place to be.
Kids
I would
work
imagine.
For me in their 20s, and they're fantastic.
They call you sir.
Yeah, they call me. Exactly. Help. when did I stop being the youngest? Now I'm not even. I mean, you know, in the old Nielsen, it's 18 to 49. I'm going to be checking out of that in one more year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to turn 49 in October. So I am absolutely asking myself, oh, my God, what happened? How did I get here? I'm going to be 50. My mother's laughing at me. She's like, I just wanted to live so long that I would live to see you turn 50. And God willing, I'll be turning 50 in a year and 4 months. Yes, I look at myself and I'm like, I know I'm healthy and all that, but I am not 30.
So we have an email
and that
here.
Hurts.
maybe 50's better. You never know.
Well, you know, I had a friend who once said to me, my 30s were better than my 20s, and my 40s were better than my 30s, and my 50s are going to be better than my 40s. I have a feeling that plays out, but I have a feeling at some point it's not true. Like, are your 90s better than your 80s? I don't know.
Maybe the 90s were better than the 80s.
Yeah.
last
For me,
question.
They were.
We just have a few seconds here. We heard from Sean, who wants to know what's keeping you up at night with regard to the production. Anything?
Flying.
Have you? Yeah.
The
there
only thing
flying.
That I have to say, the thing that keeps me up at night is ensuring the safety of my 29 actors who are on that stage and performing enormous feats of gymnastics, flying, and acting. I have to keep everybody safe.
The show Fly opens July 2nd and runs through August 18th at the Dallas Theater Center, directed by Tony Award winner Jeffrey Seller. Jeffrey, it's been such a pleasure to have you on. Thank you.
My pleasure indeed. Thank you so much, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect. Christine McConnell does our podcast, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find out about upcoming programs and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. Send comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.